From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. Christian Piccolini had no idea when he began working on his book about leaving a white supremacist movement 10 years ago that his story would be so timely and relevant at the time of his book's eventual publication. Piccolini joined a neo-Nazi skinhead group at age 14 in Chicago, where he grew up. It took him years to realize he needed to get out and start transforming his life. He then co-founded an organization called Life After Hate and began working on his book called White American Youth, My Descent into America's Most Violent Hate Movement and How I Got Out. The book has just been published. Well, he was a guest speaker at an activist pop-up show in Los Angeles, taking place all week, called Into Action. We'll be bringing you interviews and coverage from Into Action, including this conversation that I had with the former white supremacist.
Welcome to the program, Christian. Can you begin by telling our audience a little bit about you, your background, and what brings you to Into Action?
Well, thank you for having me, first of all. I'm here at Into Action because we're going to discuss how to dismantle white supremacy. And I have a very unique perspective into that because 22 years ago, I left America's most violent hate group. I was 14 years old when I got in. I spent 8 years in, got out when I was 22, and I've spent the last 20 years of my life trying to help people disengage from that same movement.
So what was the movement that you got sucked into, and how did that happen?
I was a member of one of the first members of America's first neo-Nazi skinhead group, started on the south side of Chicago in the mid-1980s. And I spent 8 years as one of America's first neo-Nazi skinheads.
What drew you in? How old were you? Was it peers that brought you in, or family?
You know, I came from a very normal family. My parents are immigrants. They came from Italy to the United States in the mid-1960s. And I felt abandoned by them as a kid because they were gone 7 days a week, 14 hours a day working. I didn't understand at that age that they were just struggling to survive as immigrants in a new country. I felt abandoned, so I went looking for another family. And at 14 years old, I was standing in an alley, and I was smoking a joint, and a man came up to me, and he pulled the joint from my mouth, and he said, "That's what the communists and the Jews want you to do to keep you docile." I didn't know what a communist or a Jew or even what the word docile meant, to be quite honest with you. But it was as if he was throwing me a lifeline. It was the first person that I felt gave me some acceptance, and he forged kind of my identity, my community, and my purpose at that point.
What role did you play in this group, and what was the overarching ideology of this neo-Nazi skinhead group?
Well, it is very similar to what we would call white nationalism today, although I defer using that term because that's a term that they came up with. It's a marketing term that they use to make themselves seem less hateful. They're white supremacists just like we were 30 years ago, and we believed wrongly that that immigration and mixing of races and allowing people from other countries and was going to destroy the white race, as if that could be possible.
So this was in the 1980s?
I was involved from 1987 to 1995.
And so what role did you play in this group?
Well, at first I was just a member. I was a young boy at 14 years old. But within just a few years, I took leadership of that organization when the person who recruited me went to prison. And it was as if I was the last person standing because so many people had gone to prison or had run away from police for violent activities. I fell into that position, and the younger people who'd been recruited after me suddenly looked to me as their leader, and I learned how to recruit through music. I was in one of America's first white power bands, and I used music as a propaganda tool and also as an educational tool to recruit young people.
What were the day-to-day activities of a group like this? I mean, did you go on street corners and stand on a soapbox and preach the ideology, or was it something else? Did you publish a magazine? How did you, what did the white supremacist ideology manifest itself as?
Well, this was before the internet, of course, but it's really not that different than what's happening today with the propaganda online and the fake news stories and the fake news sites. We were passing leaflets to other people. We were putting them under windshields. We were producing magazines. We were making music. We had record labels. We were essentially trying to push a propaganda to vulnerable young white youth.
And at some point, obviously, something changed in you. Tell us about that turning point.
Well, you know, for 8 years, I always had doubts because I wasn't raised to be racist. It wasn't part of my family DNA, but I swallowed it whole because it fulfilled, I thought it fulfilled something for me, but I was addicted to power. Ultimately, it was the compassion that people showed me, people that I least deserved it from when I least deserved it. They were people that I considered my enemies, African Americans and Jewish people and gay people. And when I had started to finally meet them, because I'd never had a meaningful interaction with anybody, but once they showed me compassion, they went out of their way to do that. They didn't have to do that, and because they knew how hateful I was. But I was able to humanize them because I was demonizing them in my head. It was prejudice. I'd never had an interaction or a dialogue. And now suddenly I was able to humanize that person that I was afraid of.
Can you tell us a story of how someone showed you compassion?
Sure. Well, I opened a record store in the mid-1990s, 1994, just before I left the movement. And the goal was to sell white power music. And I also decided...
This was again in Chicago.
This was in Chicago, yes, on the south side of Chicago. And I also sold punk rock and heavy metal and hip-hop music. And I never thought I would sell any of that music, but people came in to buy it. And one day, for a very specific instance, was a young black teen who had come into the store a few times. And I could tell he was very upset this time. And I asked him what was wrong, and he confided in me that his mother had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And I suddenly was able to relate with him because my own mother had been diagnosed with breast cancer. And we started talking, and it just became obvious that we had more in common than we had differences.
So why was music such an effective way to get this across? I mean, you know, we hear of hip-hop being, and we know that music can be powerful. We know that hip-hop was born out of black, you know, resistance, cultural resistance, and there's Christian music. Is the white power music scene burgeoning?
Well, I think you just explained it. Music is a very powerful medium. It brings people to a certain memory. It allows young people with angst to gather. It's a social networking tool. And if you were to ask me, is it burgeoning now? I would say it peaked in the 90s. But there are other tools now that are just as effective as music. Social media is, I think, the new music. It is the new virtual concert where people with the same ideas can gather and discuss ideas and spread propaganda. To me, you know, that could be very dangerous.
How did you, looking back in the very early stages after you left the movement, how did you view what you had done?
You know, I was extremely ashamed, and I had spent 5 years after I left afraid of exposing myself. I tried to outrun my past. I tried to make new friends and move and find new jobs, but. And even though I had treated people with respect during this period, I wasn't treating myself with a lot of respect. And one day, a friend came to me and she said, you know, you have to change your life because I don't want to see you die. I'd been waking up every morning wishing that I hadn't woken up.
So you, in a way, had a sort of PTSD from your experience?
I didn't understand it then, but I think I understand it better now. And I think there is some PTSD because I do feel that I did experience trauma, not only as a member of that movement, but the trauma from bringing other people into that movement and affecting their lives. And then also, I think the trauma of leaving because I had to lose everything before I realized that I had to leave. My wife left me and took my children. I lost.
Because of your role?
Yeah, she wasn't involved. And I was married at 19 and we had our first child and our second at 21. And I just didn't leave the movement quickly enough for her. I had lost my business because I closed my store when I became too embarrassed to sell the white power music. I didn't have a good connection with my family anymore because I destroyed that. And I also walked away from the only community that I knew and the only identity that I had known for most of my young life. So it took me many years to be able to seek forgiveness, but also to be able to understand how to forgive myself. And when I was able to understand what I had done and started to seek amends, that's when I realized I wanted to make sure other people didn't go down the same path that I did.
So you've written a book, White American Youth. Is this your way of telling your story, but also in a way dealing with your past?
Yeah, it was a cathartic experience to write my book, both because I had to go and search for answers that I maybe hadn't found for myself. And I did that by including other people that I had affected over those years. It was a long process to write it, because there was a lot of soul searching to do, even though I'd been doing the good work of trying to dismantle white supremacy.
And how were you doing that? Do you have an organization that you're a part of too?
I co-founded an organization called Life After Hate in 2009. I'm no longer with that organization. I've branched off to start a global intervention providers network that I'm in the process of building right now that I'm very excited about. But in my book, I think it's really a cautionary tale for any young person who's searching for an identity, a community, and a purpose, because it wasn't ideology, it wasn't dogma that drew me into that movement. That's not what brings people in. It's this broken search for who you are and where you are in the world. And somebody, if you are broken enough, will find those vulnerabilities and try to fill them in with promises of paradise.
So these experiences of yours were in the 80s and 90s. Presumably you started working on your book before Donald Trump was elected president. And here we are today at a moment in time when your book is, fortunately or unfortunately, extremely relevant. How do you view this new so-called white nationalist, alt-right, any one of the number of labels that these groups try to use today from the perspective of someone who's kind of been there and seen, you know, what it did to you and the people around you?
Well, I started writing the book 10 years ago, so well before this last election cycle. But what I'm seeing now is frankly terrifying, because so many of the things that are coming out of the administration and policies and even language are things that we said 30 years ago. Now, the messages and the words might be just a little bit more palatable, but that was a really concerted effort on our part 30 years ago. We recognized that we were too extreme for the average white racist. And we said we need to stop shaving our heads and getting tattoos and waving swastika flags, and we need to blend in. And we started this process of normalizing who we were 30 years ago. And here we are, and we're calling it white nationalism or the alt-right. Again, those are words that they created, marketing buzzwords to make themselves seem less hateful.
Right. I mean, in Charlottesville, we saw a young white man in khakis and white polo shirts.
And that was a strategy to blend in. We went to college campuses and enrolled in school. We got jobs in law enforcement. At that time, we encouraged people to run for office, to drop the boots and start wearing suits. And that, unfortunately, is what's happening today.
So if compassion is what saved you, to simplify it, is compassion what can undermine the recruitment efforts of some of these movements we're seeing today? Because my knee-jerk reaction to somebody, you know, let alone an alt-righter, white supremacist, but even someone that I might personally know as an amazing person, but I found out voted for Trump, my knee-jerk reaction is to want to dismiss them because they're part of a system that wants to see me disappear. And it's really hard to show compassion to somebody who would wish you didn't exist.
And I understand that reaction. I certainly have that reaction as well. However, I know through experience of working with over 100 people that I've helped disengage is that compassion and empathy are really the only things that reach people. If we marginalize people who feel marginalized already, that pushes them further away. If we bring them in closer and we find some sort of middle ground, and I'm not saying ideologically, the fact that we're human beings or that we're parents or that we want health and safety and security for our children and an education. Those are all things that we all have in common anywhere in the world that we go. And if we can start there, maybe, just maybe, instead of starting on the outsides and the extremes and working our way in where we never find the middle, if we just start in the middle, maybe at some point we'll go off track, but we will have at least established some sort of a connection. And I think that connection, that compassion and empathy could deter people from going down that path. But we also have to fix our system, because our system right now and our institutions are geared towards white supremacy. And until the institutions of justice and the prison systems are equal, I suspect we'll never get away from this type of racism.
What do you say to those who might just want to dismiss these white supremacist groups, leave them in the fringe, because the more you pay attention to them, the more power they draw from it?
Well, I think that there is a fine line between giving them a platform and speaking to them as a human being would speak to another human being. I'm not defending neo-Nazis. I'm not defending what happened in Charlottesville. But I know that every single person that was at that march at some point in their life turned to go down that path. They weren't always on that path. I wasn't on that path, and I went down that path. And if we can just identify young people when they're the most vulnerable and support when they're passionate or when they're idealistic about something positive, perhaps they won't hit enough walls to have to go down that path and become detoured.
But now these groups have a president. They literally have somebody with the highest power in the nation who is echoing their ideology and attempting to fulfill their fantasies.
Vote. It's just a few steps to the ballot box. Every person has the ability to change that in the future. And I think we all need to take responsibility for how we want our country to progress.
So any words of advice to people who might have somebody who may not necessarily be an overt white supremacist in their family, but someone who seems vulnerable to it, someone who voted for Trump, who starts to echo the ideology, who you find, has been secretly reading Breitbart, how we confront these? Because in many cases, these are people who are members of our family, who are members of our community, and we don't want to always write them off.
Let me just say,
I'm speaking from experience here, because I truly want advice on how to speak to one particular member of my extended family.
I think we all have that member of our family. And I think the important thing to realize is that they're operating on a certain set of information that they believe to be true. And you are operating on another set of information that you believe to be true. One side is probably more true than the other. Let me just say that, okay? But if your child, if your young 2 or 3 year old child were to come up to you, would you, and did something wrong or said something wrong, would you ostracize them? Would you push them away? Would you disown them? Would you beat them? Would you throw a bottle at their head? You would sit them down and you would have a conversation with them. And you would find some way to understand each other. That sometimes dealing with a white supremacist is like dealing with a 2-year-old child that is not operating on all the same information.
Except maybe it's not a good idea to tell them that you're talking to them as if they were a child.
I certainly wouldn't approach that. But, the same type of empathy that you would feel for, a child. To do it with caring and understanding that they believe what they believe because they, at some point, broke. And they swallowed some bit of information that poisoned their mind and set them down a different path. And somehow we need to find that middle ground to bring them back.
Christian, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
I've been speaking with Christian Picciolini, musician and co-founder of Life After Hate, author of a new book called White American Youth. And we spoke at a pop-up show in Los Angeles that's taking place all week this week called Into Action, where Picciolini was a panelist. We'll be bringing you coverage from that show for the rest of this week and into next week. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.